The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world. Why is life so meaningless and purposeless to most of us today? Why are we living as if on a giant treadmill, going nowhere, a group of nobodies going no place and not knowing why? Why is it lives are empty, meaningless, without a sense of direction? It's as if we're just snatching at passing momentary pleasures, temporal thrills. As one scientist said, science gives us no purpose or reason in living beyond just having a sort of a pleasurable experience of one kind or another. You know, most people are living that way, trying to keep out of our minds the consciousness of the real conditions of this present world and especially of the future, the perilous times in which we live today, and trying to satiate our desires for entertainment, for pleasure, for physical sensations and thrills, for excitement, for fun, for the color, the life, the sound, the water, the wind, the waves, the sort of a merry-go-round of physical, sensual thrills that human beings seem to love today. And we're just not convinced the world is as bad as it really is. Matter of fact, I got a letter the other day. I thought I might as well read from a man in the United Kingdom. He said, "Why do you try to brainwash people into believing that the world around them will really be all right if they turn to God?" Now, I'm coming to that a little later as to whether or not there is such a being as a God, and there are only two alternatives, after all. Either you are an accident and doomed to live an accidental life and die in an accident, or else you were planned and there is a purpose in your living, and you ought to find out what the purpose is. But he said, "Your view of life would really make living dull. To even try to obey those Ten Commandments would be crazy and near impossible." He said, "I like the world as it is. Alcohol, promiscuous sex, LSD trips, and so on. And millions of others like it this way also. Religious people live in a make-believe world," he said. And I agree with that. I think that many religious people live in a make-believe world. But depends on what kind of religion, whose religion it is, and just what those people are like. But I believe this man is living in a far greater make-believe world than many religious people of whom I know. Talk about a make-believe world. What do you call alcoholism, drug addiction, and LSD? But he is saying, "Why do you keep knocking England and the United States so much on your radio programs?" Well, I'll tell you that too. Because we're doomed unless we turn around and go the other way. Because our nations are going to come crashing down with the biggest flood that has ever occurred in history unless we change our national course and direction. And because I love the United States and Great Britain, and because I would sure hate to see it occur. But we're headed that direction if we have the wit to see it, and most of us don't. We don't want to believe it, but then no nation ever listened to any kind of a warning and turned around and went the other way, except one, and that was the capital of ancient Assyria, Nineveh, at the preaching of Jonah centuries ago. The Romans didn't. The ancient Greeks didn't. The Persians didn't. The Babylonian Empire didn't listen to any warning. The ancient Israelites and the people of the house of Judah didn't listen to it. The Americans didn't listen in pre-World War II days or pre-World War I days, and we're not listening today. He says, "Why do you keep knocking England?" I'm not knocking England, I'm knocking human nature. And he says, "The United States." Well, about time somebody began to expose all the crime and promiscuousness, the pornography, the mounting venereal disease, the preoccupation with every type of violence you can begin to imagine, the breakup and dissolution of homes, the horrible crimes that we're perpetrating upon our own children, our own minds, lives, and bodies. Well, he said, these are the two greatest countries of this wicked earth. I have to agree. If we are going to get off with comparing ourselves among ourselves and comparing ourselves by ourselves, yes, I have to say, a couple of the greatest countries on this wicked earth. But he said it, I didn't. He said this wicked earth. He's admitting it's a wicked earth. But what good's it going to do you to say that we're the best of all the wicked? Now, he says, I'm not saying that everything is all right with the world today. Oh, good. Glad of that. But he says, it isn't as lousy as you lead us to believe. Oh, yes, it is. It's a lot more lousy than I could ever lead you to believe. And he said, finally, if there is a heaven and hell, well, there is, but not in the way that most people think of it. But then I will save that for later, because that's another subject and quite theological. He says, then I hope you go to hell because that's where all the fun people will be. I think he's heard a record that I played for a class one time called, I think it was something about Dante's Inferno or something like that, that was sort of acted out by people, and they had the idea that people go either to heaven, and they're up there lazing around heaven in retirement all the time, or else they go to hell, where they leap lightly, I guess, from brick to brick, trying to beat at the flames which threaten to engulf their body, never quite burning up and yet never quite putting the fire out. This is the type of thing that you hear preached today. Well, that was one man's opinion. But, you know, he admitted the world is a pretty horrible place, but yet he said, at least we're living in the two nations that are better. Now, that is not quite right. I don't think you would get the people in Australia or in New Zealand, people I know of in Canada, people I know of in Switzerland, in parts of France, in Germany, and other countries to agree with you. But at any rate, that was his opinion. But the average person, you see, will not look at the perilous times in which we live because he's afraid for the future and he won't admit it to himself. This poor man's fearful about the future. He knows that alcoholism, sexual promiscuity, drug addiction, LSD trips are going to take this world right straight to its extinction. He knows that, and so do you, if we don't change it. But he's not willing to look into it and to turn around and go the other way. Well, what about you? People are asking, what shall I do with my life? You ask a teenager, college student, what are you going to do in life? What is your plan or your purpose? And he says, well, I'm a freshman. I haven't decided yet. But the question confronting so many millions is, how should I live? What do I want out of life? What is my purpose in being? What should be my goal? Science answers? I don't know. Religion answers? Heaven or hell? The social order answers? Get more things, higher job, higher social plateau or stratum, achieve, accumulate, get, acquire, go, 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 here and there and the other place. But they don't have any real reason for doing all of this. You search everywhere, and you won't find the answers to those questions. Serious students of psychology may feel that somewhere in some book they will find the magic paragraph that is marked with an X, and right there it will unlock to their minds every great and lofty and visionary idea they've ever wanted to find as to precisely what human beings are, why we are here, what our lives are all about, and where we're going. People believe you may find the answers to these things in textbooks on philosophy, on ethics, on psychology, on perhaps pragmatism or history or theology or something. But we become quickly conditioned in the higher educational institutions of today to the idea that there are no answers to these most important questions. As a matter of fact, there are whole lectures and whole series of classes which are expressly put together for the purpose of teaching students you can't find the answers. We call it new morality. We like to dress up immorality in a tuxedo and call it by a different name. But why give up so quickly? Why not go clear back to the beginning? Can you do that? Can you begin at the beginning with any facet of your life and ask yourself what are the two alternatives? Now, it's been said by a wise philosopher long ago, there is nothing new under the sun. And that's a fact. There isn't anything new. I can take a pen and look at it, and it's made of products that have been around on this earth for a long time. Metal that was mined out of the ground that came out of rocks and had to be melted down and smelted, and the ore refined, mixed together with other metals and put into a type of a mixture that is stainless steel or chromium or various mixtures. And plastic, which probably is either vegetable and comes therefore from some of the herbs that we grow, or it is probably a coal tar derivative or comes from petroleum, one of the petroleum byproducts, which is nothing more than decaying vegetation and bodies of ancient animals that have been in the earth for all these millions of years, so they would have us believe. There's nothing new under the sun. You encase your feet in the hide of animals. Where did the animals come from? Where did it all start? Take life and take the elements and the physical material creation and wade back into the yesteryears with it and begin at the beginning. Now, why not begin with matter? Matter does exist. So start with the universe, the vastness of the limitless universe. It had to come from somewhere. Now, men tell you the universe just sort of happened. And then they try to tell you in various theories about how the solar system happened. Now, this too is a giant accident, they tell you. And then they try to tell you how the Earth sort of happened. And it's the least little result of all of this giant accident of all. It is a little cinder that apparently sort of splattered off this giant collision. It depends on what you want to believe. There are a lot of ideas on it. And it gradually cooled, and then over the years, it either got cold enough or hot enough, they're not sure, for life to evolve upon it. Now, let me just show you the two alternatives. You only have two. They are either evolution or creation. Either everything evolved, either it just happened, and it's all an accident, and therefore you are an accident, and your life is an accident, and has no plan or purpose, and you better even forget about the idea as to why I'm here, where am I going, is there any sense of fulfillment that I can achieve in my life, is there any purpose in my being, forget about it. Do like this fellow does, say, I love the world with LSD and drug addiction and alcoholism, forget it. Let our kids be given to the gristmill of war. Let's all be blasted into nothingness in a giant atomic explosion. Or else ask yourself some simple and important questions. Now, if evolution is true, you're an accident, and your entire life is accidental, and you're going to die in an accident, and that's all you were, just a sort of a happenstance, a nothingness in this earth and in this span of time allotted to us we call life. But if the universe was planned, and if the solar system was planned, then your life was planned, and there is a plan and a purpose for your life, and you ought to be busy fulfilling that purpose, because at the end of it, there are some fantastic rewards. It's either or. These are the two alternatives. Now, can you wade right back to the beginning and ask yourself, can you, the layman, prove it? Or are you bamboozled by degrees because somebody says he's a doctor of this or that? Or he's been studying the mating habits of monarch butterflies for years. You think he's got all the answers? You don't go along with theologians. They've got degrees. You don't go along with politicians just because they may have degrees or honorary doctorates of the law. So why do you begin to be bamboozled and buffooned by the statements of evolution? Now, here is an article from a driller's journal. It has to do with the principles of geology. And it pretty much gives you a summarization about the ideas of where the solar system and the Earth came from. How did it all begin? This article summarizes several theories as to the origin of the raw material from which the Earth was formed do exist and are quite reasonable. Now, this is kind of funny. There are several theories, widely divergent, and they are quite reasonable. However, it goes on, the hypothesis that the Earth was formed from a huge gaseous cloud. A giant gaseous cloud. Now, I like that description because that more or less sounds to me like the proportions of the theory itself, like a giant gaseous cloud. This article goes on, this huge gaseous cloud is probably most widely accepted today, as we must use something as a starting point. Now, I agree with that. You've got to start somewhere. And as we want to avoid stepping into the realm of theology and as we... Then they're not going to start the same place you and I are going to start in this program, are they? They're going to start somewhere else. They're going to exclude 50% of the whole problem before they begin. Now, would you like to do this? If maybe you're a counselor, you got two people, male and female, coming to you to settle their divorce dispute. You kick one of them out the room, and you hear the other story. You think you're going to get all the facts straight? Well, here's the admission. As we want to avoid stepping into the realm of theology and philosophy, oh, you bet they do. And I suppose many theologians want to avoid stepping into the realm of science and biology and geology and so on. And I don't think that's fair of either one of them. I'd like to get my feet good and wet in both areas and come up with the right solution. But this article said, we shall use as our beginning the time in the history of the earth when it may have consisted, it says here, only of a gigantic turbulent cloud. Now, not that it did. I mean, these are words on paper. It may have consisted of a giant turbulent cloud of gas. But then, of course, we could have said, and we could begin with a time when it may not have consisted of a giant turbulent cloud of gas. Whichever way you'd like to put it down, it's of equal value. But in reading it, people don't realize that often enough. With no particular shape, and certainly no solid form. As the cloud grew larger, now we've got a definite past tense. First it may have been, now as it grew larger. And on it goes. Well, that talks about the appreciable gravitational pull and how everything began to develop from that. Well, that's one beginning. Now, another one is very dramatic. I read to you recently. This is the sort of a thing that you read in the beginning sections of college-level evolutionary textbooks. And here is, from the evolutionary standpoint, to investigate one of these two great alternatives, what evolution says to describe to you about life, about you and the way you're living your life. Life presumably began on Earth 2 to 3 billion years ago. Now that 1 billion years they throw around like it is more or less just a plaything. It reminds me, as I've said before, about the two professors that were gazing into this huge telescope. Now, apparently, they don't really look into these things. They just take pictures from them, like the 100-inch or more type telescopes that take pictures of astral bodies and so on. But they're looking into it, and one of them wept up with alarm. His hair stood straight up. And he ran to the other one. He said, "Professor Smedley, Professor Smedley," he says, "what on Earth is going to happen to us?" He said, "I just discovered there is a giant star approaching the Earth, and in 3 billion years, we're all going to be blasted out of extinction." They both got very alarmed and excited. Smedley said, "What did you say again, old boy? Calm down and tell me about it." He said, "I said that this giant star approaching the Earth 3 billion years from now, I figured by my calculations, we're all going to be blasted out of existence and the Earth is going to be extinct." He says, "Oh," he said, "thank goodness you clarified that. I thought there for a minute you said 3 million years." Some of these textbooks are a little loose with the way they toss around the years. Life presumably, that's a big word, began on Earth 2 to 3 billion years ago. One third off. And even that calculation. Well, it goes on. For hundreds of millions of years before, this planet had circled the burning sun, utterly devoid of any living thing. To be sure, it pulsed with powerful physical forces. Oh, it was active. It was sort of alive, because we know that physical forces are living laws, living forces. They act. They act upon us, and we must get in harmony with them. Aeronautical engineers know this. Designers of aircraft wings know it. It pulsed with powerful physical forces, they say. Great winds blew mightily, or soft breezes caressed stony mountains. Rains fell, and volcanoes and earthquakes rent the earth. Seas swelled and diminished, continents rose up and eroded. Lightning darted and thunder rolled, and gorgeous sunset painted young skies. But there was nothing living to bear witness. Then, by scientific theory, a spark of life was struck. This is under the title, "Researchers Probe Life Beginnings." It's an article on the subject of evolution. It shows you the type of an approach to the subject that is quite rampant today in most of the textbooks you'll read on the subject. Here's another one that talks about a totally different theory from the warm, diluted soup that some of them talk about, or the scum, or some of them have the idea of slime. Some is brown, some is green, some don't even tell you what color it was. But here's one. "Did life start in the ice age? New theory," it says. "Intense cold might have started life on Earth, according to a new theory proposed by a team of California researchers. The earliest building blocks of the materials of life might have rained down in hailstones." What's the old saying? What goes up must come down. So somehow they've got the idea now that through evaporation and dust particles in the air, and then through some type of condensation, and then ice particles or hailstones coming down, that life started that way. Well, I'll read it to you for what it's worth. "The earliest building blocks of the materials of life might have rained down in hailstones, also formed on the Earth's surface. Such processes occurred more than 3 billion years ago, when no life existed on our planet. Three researchers have advanced the following possible explanation of what might have really happened around 4 billion years ago. It was one of the earliest ice ages, at least low temperature epochs, on the Earth. Around the Earth was an atmosphere in which there was no free oxygen, but an abundance of methane, ammonia, and nitrogen gases. It's interesting how they can even tell us exactly what gases were present. A lot of it talks about huge clouds of gases, and I always think that's interesting. Then it goes on to talk about low temperatures, many degrees below the temperature of ice, prevailed. Past tense. Definite past. It's as if they know this. But remember, the whole thing is just a wild guess. So the atomic combinations of hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon, and oxygen were jammed together by freezing. Such packing and condensing resulted in the production of substances for future life building, with more and more cold condensations. After the freezings had formed, the first building blocks of proteins and nucleic acids, and clicked them into even the earliest self-producing things like viruses there was no more formation of life out of non-life. Eventually, the coal passed away. Warmer times came. That'd make a terrific script for some kind of a Broadway play. Maybe little fairy-like dancers could be the ice particles, and they could mingle together. You know, all this could happen in color and sight and sound. And it would be very dramatic, I think, to stage something like that, perhaps. Now, you know, evolution ridicules the first chapter of Genesis. They really do. Not all scientists do, but evolutionists generally do. And, of course, some people try to straddle a fence and have both. They try to say, well, there is a God, yes. This is, I suppose, to get along with religious people and their own conscience. But they say that God, if there is a God, it's a blind, sort of a dumb God, a hip pocket God, a God that you carry around in your wallet. It's a God who is your sort of companion in time of need and to give you solace and comfort. It's a sort of a metaphysical dean or a spiritual tranquilizer God, an ancient, shop-worn old uncle who will give you comfort when you need it. The kind of God that many people envision. And this God, who certainly in the minds of theistic evolutionists who try to straddle the fence and to tell you, well, evolution is just God's tool. Now, they believe in a sort of a God, but apparently the God was only powerful enough to mix methane, ammonia, the various hydrocarbons, and so on, either freeze it or heat it, take your pick, because they believe both extremes, and then cause it to gradually sort of create life out of the not living. Evolution made easy is this next article. It's amazing because each one of these are so different. Now this one says it took fish 600 million years to evolve into man. This was determined recently by biophysicists at the Carnegie Institution. Experiments on which they reported gave researchers insights into the evolutionary relationships among animals. Their time scale shows a break of approximately 200 million years between fish and bird. Another 200 million years later, the earliest mammals evolved from bird-like ancestry. They were creatures believed roughly similar to the extremely primitive armadillo. Now, it wasn't long ago, this sort of gives you a headache. It wasn't long ago that I told you that the closest living relatives to our little birds, including ruby-throated hummingbirds and giant albatrosses with 12-foot wingspread, and that's phenomenal. That's the size of any of your bedrooms. That's a big bird. The closest living relatives to these birds of all types and sizes are crocodiles. Now they're telling us from ancient bird-like creatures, armadillos came. It's sort of a head-whirling situation you're in when you begin looking at evolution, isn't it? It is speculated that the monkeys of the New World are people who believe in it. No, it is speculated that the monkeys of the New World slightly preceded those of the Old World. From thence it was a relatively short step of only a few million years to the highest animals, the chimpanzee and man. They call that a relatively short step. How about that? Of only a few million years to the highest animals, the chimpanzee and the man. Now, if I could give you a definition of evolution, I'd like you to listen to this because it's a little tough, I agree, for the average person to get. Oh, one more thing first. It says, another theory about man. Man and other living creatures of the earth may have evolved from polka-dotted air bubbles in the sea. Now, I think this is about as funny as ice crystals. This is offered by a Yale scientist, Dr. P.J. Wangerski, and he says that life, living creatures, man included, may have evolved from polka-dotted air bubbles in the sea. This was an oceanographic discovery. The theory was offered by a Yale scientist. His theory was based on laboratory experiments believing to simulate seawater chemistry, giving evidence that non-living organic particles are constantly being formed on air bubbles in the sea. That is, that air bubbles attract dissolved materials. Now, I think it gets funnier all the time to me, in a sense, that each one of the theories is either a giant cloud of gas or little air bubbles. It's always some... It's a handful of wind. When you really begin to think about it, it's a handful of wind, any way you look at it. Now, these little hands full of wind, which were coming up in air bubbles out of the sea, the idea is that this mechanism of particles adhering to the bubbles may have been an important step in the long process of evolution from chemical substances to primitive life in the sea. And if this is true, these organic blobs formed on air bubbles in the sea might be the progenitors of all life on the planet. My friends, you can really take your pick. You can believe anything. Maybe it happened in reverse. I don't know. You know, it depends. When you talk about evolution, you can come up with any wild theory you would like, and it's just as good. It's got just as much tangible value. It's probably going to be just about as acceptable as anything you've heard so far. Now, here is the kind of intellectual pressure to which many people are subjected. This is in a book on the subject of evolution that is a little more along the line of the academic or the educational institution, the collegiate level, shall I say, rather than the newspaper releases and the Associated and United Press and all of that type of thing that you see in the science writers and newspapers and magazines. They generally put it in layman's language. This is not in the layman's language. And here's the kind of pressure to which the average person is subjected. It says this: no informed persons doubt anymore that the many animal types that inhabit the earth today are the results of a long process of evolution. To understand how this evolution has happened is one of the major tasks of biology. The course which evolution must have taken has been deduced mainly from the study of fossils. Another quote: this, in a very small nutshell, is the essence of modern evolutionary theory. Fossils provide the student of animal structure with a kind of direct, although very fragmentary, historical documentation. Unfortunately, fossils do not behave. And so we have no direct knowledge of the course behavioral evolution has followed in the past. Quotation from a book called Animal Behavior, The Life Nature Library by Nico Tinbergen, on pages 171 and 172. No informed person doubts it. All this fragmentary evidence, the unfortunate fact that fossils don't behave, and the fact that evolutionists have no direct knowledge. Oh yes, they do. Plenty of informed people doubt it. And one of them, a biologist named Edwin Conklin, said this: the probability of life originating from accident is comparable to the probability of the unabridged dictionary resulting from an explosion in a print shop. Well, that's a pretty good quote to let it rest with, I think, there for this one program. I'll go into it more thoroughly next time. We're going to start with the universe, with the solar system, with the earth and life upon it, and I am going to give you 7 major proofs that there is a God Almighty in heaven above who rules and who is working out a purpose and a program here below, which purpose and program you can uncover and clearly define for yourself and find out your life has a great purpose that you ought to be busily fulfilling. So don't miss a single broadcast in the series, and write in for the booklet called The Wonderful World Tomorrow that shows you what Bible prophecy says about the future, because 1/3 of the Bible is prophecy, and it talks about our world today and what it will be like in the world tomorrow. Be sure to write for that booklet. It's free of charge. There is no price for it. And also the current number of the Plain Truth Magazine. Every month an article on evolution and other articles and features. It's free of charge, no price, if you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Remember, there is no follow-up, no request for money. The address again in just a moment. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.